Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a split-screen special spoiler cast episode for Assassin's Creed Origins. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I'm editor-at-large for Kotaku.com. I will be your host today, along with a couple of guests that I will introduce in a moment. Assassin's Creed Origins is a game by Ubisoft Montreal. It was released in October of last year for PS4, Xbox One, and PC. It tells the story of Bayek of Siwa and his wife Aya, two grieving parents who set out on a quest across Egypt during the time of Cleopatra to avenge their son, and in the process found the Order of Assassins. I am joined today to discuss the game by two of my colleagues at Kotaku, both of whom are long-standing Assassin's Creed fans. For past games in this series, we would have gotten out all of our thoughts in writing after we finished the games, but this time I talked them into coming on our podcast instead. Over in New York, we've got Kotaku Editor-in-Chief Stephen Totillo. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Kirk. I love talking Assassin's Creed.
Well, then you are in the right place. Also, from way across the Pacific in Canberra, we've got Kotaku contributing editor Luke Plunkett. Hey, Luke.
Hey, everybody.
So, we've got a lot of ground to cover today. This is a very big game. So, first of all, this is a spoiler cast, so any listeners who haven't finished Assassin's Creed Origins and maybe you're thinking about it or don't want to hear story spoilers for this game, this isn't the podcast for you. This is going to be a spoiler cast. Second, this is a bonus episode, so we will have a normal episode of Kotaku Split Screen as usual on Thursday later this week. So let's start with some big picture thoughts. Stephen, let's start with you. What did you think of Assassin's Creed Origins?
I love when Desmond came back to life at the end and Connor teamed up with Ezio. We're spoiling everything, right? So we're talking about the super secret ending?
Right. Get right into the super secret, the post-credit scene where Nick Fury shows up.
I wish. Well, no, I don't wish for that. I like it a lot, but it is not probably even in my top five Assassin's Creed games, which I think says more about how much some of the prior games in the series appealed to me than this one. But this one has grown on me the more I played it. I finished the story about a week ago. I'm at level 36 out of 40. I think this is the second best open world I've ever been in behind Breath of the Wild in terms of just beauty and my desire to continue to explore it. I like the protagonist a lot. I have some issues with the story. Wish the modern day was better. So there's a lot I like. Some stuff I'm not super crazy about. So yeah, maybe it's like my sixth or seventh favorite AC game, which for me is still pretty good.
All right, that's pretty good. Luke, overall thoughts on Origins?
Kind of similar. I really appreciate some of the new things they tried in this game. And I think some of the things that they try that work, like the combat, the open world design, I think work really well. Some of the other things they've tried to implement, like the structure of the story and the leveling system in particular, I think maybe don't work quite so well. I'd probably rank it higher than Steven. I think it's probably my second favorite behind... Oh, maybe third. I'll backtrack that. Maybe third.
What's
behind,
it behind?
Syndicate and Black Flag,
okay.
Which, you know, I thought they were a bit more focused. I think it's a really good foundation for the next game. I don't usually like to fall into that trap of hyping up, you know, future games on the back of this one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think they'll very quickly learn that now that they've rebooted it and tried all this new stuff, I think the stuff that worked, if they can focus on that, it'll be amazing.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting way to look at this game. So everybody, you know, I believe everybody knows at this point that this game had an extra year in development, which is definitely shows in a lot of things about the game, just in the sheer size of it and in the way that they've overhauled a lot of these systems. And it seems very, very different. I guess I've said my piece so many times on regular split screen episodes that I'll maybe ask you guys first and then weigh in. But Stephen, what do you think about the ways that the Assassin's Creed formula is different in this game, the things that Ubisoft Montreal added?
The combat, Luke and I might be in disagreement about, because I actually don't think the combat changes were that successful. They're different, and they're they're solidly done, but I don't prefer this combat system to the old one, other than it being a change of pace. The old combat system was criticized for it becoming this sort of turn-taking dance where you'd be kind of squaring off with three enemies, and then it would just be, you know, wait for each one to attack, do the counter, do the kill, and it became very routine. This one has more dynamic, right? It's based on range and whether you can reach the hitbox of the enemy and the speed with which different weapons swing. I guess that's more of a Souls-style combat. It's different, but I actually think that high levels of lethality with minimal movement is what is most sort of exemplary of an assassin, or at least the kind of assassins mm-hmm. that we were sort of trained on in the other games that we've played. To me, the prototypical Assassin's Creed maneuver shows up in Assassin's Creed Brotherhood when Ezio is just walking down the street and whistles, and one of his assassin minions just jumps out of a haystack and kills somebody or jumps down. So it's like as suave as you can be. But I also like, I like the turn-taking combat that eventually would turn into these flourishes of instant kills in sequence that you saw in several of the sort of middle Assassin's Creed games. Maybe this combat system, which is more brutal, befits this character. Maybe we could look back and say this is an earlier time in the lineage of assassins, and therefore they were less refined in how they killed. They had less technology to enable them to perform slicker, more efficient ways of killing. But I don't know. I don't love the change to the combat, and I would be I'm leery of them actually building on this combat any more than they already have, because it already takes me away from the kind of feeling I like to have when I play an Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, I gotta say that I've played a lot more of this game now. I played 60 hours or something on PC after playing it on PS4, so I've played a ton, and I've really gotten comfortable with and used to the various systems in the game, and the combat system is just a little weird. I think what Luke said earlier about how this could be a foundation for improvement, I kind of do feel that with this combat system. I think it's got the seed of something cool. It's not quite Dark Souls. It's a little stickier than that. It has this kind of rubber bandy feeling that I don't really like. Steven, I was complaining to you the other day about the elephant fights mm-hmm. that I've been trying to do. Luke, did you do any of the elephant fights?
No, only the boss one, and that turned me off
the one in
idea
the story.
Entirely.
Right,
yeah.
right. So there are four of them that you can do once you finish the story, and they're just kind of not very fun. I at some point I'm sure I'll beat them because I've kind of gotten the completionist bug with this game, but it's your dodge, your move set, and especially your mobility and dodge in combat just isn't really set up to deal with like Dark Souls boss sized enemies, this towering thing that's swinging this gigantic, you know, its head at you. So it just doesn't work that well for every situation, but it is more interesting, I think. Like, I get what you're saying, I guess, Steven, that you want an assassin to be doing cool assassin moves. But in combat, there is always this kind of, I'm thinking, oh, that guy's got a shield, so if I knock his shield back, I'm going to use my ult on that dude to take him out and then clear a path through these guys to get out, because I generally am playing on a high enough difficulty, I stay out of combat. And I think that's interesting, the kind of weaving in and out of blades and having that actually matter right. and the lack of magnetism that used to be there. So I guess I like that part.
I found it actually encourages you to play the game as more of an assassin. I think the previous combat system, it got to a point, especially around sort of 3 and Black Flag, where it was encouraging an almost Shadow of Mordor, Arkham kind of style, where you feel like you could yeah. rush into an area and take on 10, 20 bad guys, and you'd come out on top because you could just parry combo.
Right.
I feel like this combat system, because it doesn't support large fights, like if you end up taking on more than sort of 2 or 3 people at a time, it's really dangerous. I feel like that's gently ushering you towards a more assassin-y style of play with stealth, with ambushing people, and particularly the range combat, which, you know, is massively expanded on from previous games. So I found all the tools available to me for the stealth style of playing, I was exploring them more because of the combat. I felt like the combat was there. Okay, if you get jumped by one guy, it's fine. You can take him on like that, or for the arena battles, it's fine. But if you're infiltrating a fort or an area where there's 20 guys to take on, it was sort of more encouraging you to use the eagle, use the haystacks, use your blade, use your arrows, use your tools, use all that stuff at your disposal instead of just relying on brute force all the time, which I think a lot of people sort of would fall into once they alerted the bad guys in a previous game.
I guess that's true, but I actually find that the bow and arrow is so good that I just use that all the time for everything, and I don't actually
and that's
use
great.
Most of those other tools. So Maybe that's something we can get into in a moment. Is I think that there's some redundancy and overlap. Stephen, you had another thought on the combat.
Well, I first of all, the brute force actually is working for me fine. I'm playing at hard difficulty level with auto scaling, so I'm always fighting enemies that are the same level of difficulty as me. And even still, I am usually able to go into a battle, keep L1 pressed to keep my shield up, charge R2, I think it is, to have the heavy melee attack charged up. And then I just wait for the moment when the guy's finished his attack animation. I jump in, I knock his shield back, and then I'm all over him. And I'm able to brutalize most of the people that I'm fighting. I did upgrade a lot of that top part of the skill tree, more so than I did the range stuff on the left. And Kirk, maybe you want to talk about the tool stuff. Let's talk about it, because I'm intrigued by Luke, that you explored more of the stealth stuff. I wanted to do more of the stuff that's on the right-hand side of the skill tree, but I just didn't find myself drawn to the actual mechanics of those moves. I was like, oh, taming animals, sleep darts, this stuff sounds neat, but I never needed it, and I never found it that satisfying to use when I dabbled with it, so I didn't do it, so I fought as a brute.
Yeah, I think the game has an issue sometimes with giving you too many solutions to very simple problems, and that... You know, it kind of steps on itself a lot. Like you said, I think there's partly an interface problem with tools, and that's just that you can only have one tool highlighted at one time, and there's no way to just toggle between them in the middle of the game. So if I go from a situation where I'd want to have a firebomb, and then suddenly I want to switch to a sleeping dart, I have to go into the menu to do that, and right. I just don't care. So I just don't think of it. I think of my bows as being the two stealth things that I'm using. I don't really break out the tools very much. And there's also just the fact that, I don't know, they've added a few things that were in old Assassin's Creed games, like the enrage thing that you can do. Did either of you guys unlock that ability where you can enrage
an
NPC and he had
the berserk
mode? Mm-mm. So I used that all the time. I remember, I think it was in Black Flag. That was the most OP useful tool because it was ranged. It was like a ranged dart, but it's not ranged in Origins. And I don't actually have it unlocked, but I can't really imagine a situation where I'd be looking down at, a couple of guys and would think, oh, I'm going to sneak up and enrage that guy. Unless I was just wanted to see it because it would be fun. It just seems like it's so much easier to just ace a guy with a bow and then, or do a chain assassination on two guys, that I don't know why I would use the tools. Luke, do you find yourself using the tools more?
I did, because this will probably relate to something we'll talk to you later, but I was rushing through the main story of the game, I was constantly finding myself underleveled when I'd reached certain thresholds.
That's how I played it the first time too.
Yeah, and so when I'd hit those points where I was clearly underleveled and would go from, two sword slashes taking out a bad guy to needing 30, I found myself using the tools more often because I didn't want to, I'd started a quest, I'd scoped a fortress or whatever out. I didn't want to back away from that now. I'd sort of committed to it. So I'm like, all right, I'm in this. I need to finish this mission now. So I'm going to use everything at my disposal to do it. And so I would just empty my inventory to sort of try and chip away at those health bellies of guys that I really shouldn't have been taking on, but I did find them useful for that sort of stuff. But I also liked using them just because I was getting bored of headshots from bows and from, stealth assassinations jumping off a ledge. I was like, yeah, well, I've done that about 6,000 times. I'm going to try the poison dart, the sleep dart. And I did sort of enjoy just mixing it up. If you're having to kill 30 guys on a raid mission or an exterminate mission, or whatever they call the ones where you've got to clear out a fort, I enjoyed just mixing it up. I'd kill some guys with swords, some guys with bows. It just felt more, I don't know. Something was compelling me to do that, where normally a game would not have.
Did any of you ever... Did you guys ever tame animals and use the animals to fight?
No. I've never done that.
No. Because I always wanted the pelts. I always just wanted to free them for half a second and then murder them so I could skin them and make my arrows better.
The feeling I kind of get with some of that stuff that you're talking about, and just that whole right side of the skill tree, basically, is that this game was built with a very basic gameplay loop, and they built a whole ton of that gameplay loop, right? I mean, that's kind of my knock on this game, and also my recommendation of it is that it's just this, it's a good game to relax if you kind of just want to kick back and just play through a beautiful area, but it's not going to provide a lot of variety. And the experience of playing at level 40 in the hardest base isn't very different than the experience you had at level 1 playing through the very first base you cleared out at the beginning, right? There's not a whole lot of gameplay variety from start to finish. So that's kind of a knock against it. And then it feels a little like they built that game and then they said, okay, and now we're going to add these interesting garnishes if like just sort of half baked on the right side, and they all just kind of feel half baked to me. And it doesn't even have with the optional things that you would have. Like the thing you're talking about, Luke, is very player driven. If you're in a base and you think, well, I have to kill all these guys, I might as well make it interesting. What old Assassin's Creed games would do, they would give you the optional objectives, you know, with each mission or each outpost. It would be, you know, kill three guys from cover, or, you know, take down three guys using poison, or make one berserk person kill two others or something. And it would give you a sense of this additional objective. And I don't know, maybe I like that kind of structure. I'm not ambitious or player driven.
Yeah, I enjoy not being myself. I like not being told that stuff. Like that sort of drip fed hand led tutorial sort of system running through the game. I much prefer to just have it there. Like, yeah, I've played like 9 Assassin's Creed games. I know how this rolls. Like I don't need you to point this stuff out to me. I know what a sleep dart does. Like I know a situation, I can use it. It's cool to just have it there as an option. Like I'm saying true. I enjoyed it. I still did 95% of my kills with a bow. But
right.
You know, it was nice to have them there.
Luke, did you know, according to one of the loading screen tooltips, that you can take a corpse of a freshly killed enemy and you can put it in the water, and because they have river currents in all the cities, the enemy will, the corpse will float away, and it's a way to basically clean up after yourself?
I've seen it happen, like incidentally. I didn't know it was a purposeful thing you could do.
I wonder how many things there are like that in the game that they've developed as parts, as systems that they expected us to interact with, that we're failing. And I have the same anxiety, Kirk, that you have, which is that maybe this sort of speaks poorly of me as a gamer, that I need to be given an optional objective in order to actually use the sleep dart more than once. But the game, you know, is it better that the game just kind of makes these options available to you? I look at something, you know, something that's designed so masterfully like Breath of the Wild, and it finds its ways to nudge you towards trying a variety of things. I've talked, I think, in a previous podcast I did with you about how I would never have thought that you could throw the rusty weapons into the Octorok and have them spit them out, you know, shiny. And I thought somebody just discovered that randomly. But there is a remote spot in the game where they actually teach you that exact thing, and they teach it to you wordlessly. And I found myself, when I would interview Assassin's Creed Origins developers, like the creative director, Ashraf Ismail, he would talk about how, oh, all the characters are on a schedule. It's kind of like, he didn't liken it to Fable, but I thought of it like Fable. And they're all in this kind of clockwork system, and they wake up, and they eat, and they go to work, and they go to bed. And, you know, therefore, when you have to assassinate them, you can interact with, you know, see where they are in their daily cycle and what's going to be more advantageous to you. Conceptually, sounds terrific. But I never really interacted with that system. I wonder, actually, if the Assassin's Creed Origins that I'm not interacting with is even better than the game I am enjoying, but if there's an even better game in there that I just have not quite grokked, and that could be something that they could tease out better in a sequel, is if they have all these clockwork systems and all these side alternate ways of doing things, if they could maybe design the game in a way that leads me towards some of that, at least to experiment, would be to the better, I think.
I think, yeah, I actually get the feeling that this game, there's a version of this game somewhere on some cutting room floor that is that game. And, you know, it does give you that information, then you have to use it. There are so many times where you have an assassination contract and it tells you this information at the corner of the screen. Oh, he likes to go to the market at night, and during the day he'll be out on patrol. And then I think Senu is just the band-aid that was applied across a lot of this stuff. Your eagle Senu, which is you'll call her up and then suddenly, boom, you just see where your target is. And there's no real way around that. You get close enough within 100 whatever clicks or distance points according to the map, and it just tells you call up Senu, and then Senu just tells you, you just highlight the thing, and you do that over and over again. So all of that specific information is just rendered meaningless. It's sort of similar to the fact that the bow and arrow is so powerful that you don't need to use sleep darts or whatever else. And the game just never strips you of that. They experiment with it. What, there's like that one assassination you have to do. One of the main targets is a guy who, there are four priests who look just like him, but he has a cough, and you have to identify the guy who's coughing. Like, that was kind of cool, I thought. And
there's the side quest, the side quest where Senu is missing, where you have to run around without Senu in the Northeast. It's that optional.
Oh, really?
One.
Oh, I think that's one of the only ones I didn't do in that region in the Northeast.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Because I haven't done that. So, yeah, I was surprised there wasn't more of that in the game, even though when we play as Aya toward the end, there's a lengthy stealth section when Aya is heading to assassinate Caesar at the very end of the game, where suddenly you have to do this really crowded stealth area that I didn't really have very much fun with at all because I didn't have Senyu. I couldn't tag enemies. I didn't have that advantage anymore. And it felt like the stealth system had been designed around that. So without it, I was sort of annoyed, even though I'm also sometimes annoyed at how Senyu gives me too much information, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like Senyu. I'd like to see... I saw some discussion amongst some Assassin's Creed fans on the AC subreddit today about how they were like, the person said, I was skeptical about Senyu, but, and having a drone in an AC game, but now I don't want there to be one without one.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was thinking that about the zip line from Assassin's Creed Syndicate, where I'm like, wait, I don't have to climb buildings anymore. I can have a zip line. I don't know if I'm ever going to, or whatever, the grappling hook. I don't know if I could play an AC game without it. They probably can come up with settings where I won't mind it, especially if they have something new, like grappling hook 1 year, drone the next year. Okay, maybe there's something else. But I really liked Senyu at the same time that I probably use Senyu too much. And yeah, if there was a way they could have weakened Senyu a little bit, it may have been for the better.
I'm surprised there isn't some sort of an interface option or gameplay setting option where you can turn all that off. And there may be hidden in some menu that I haven't seen, but I haven't seen one. And it would be cool if there were just a way to turn off Senyu's ability to tell you, I don't know, where things are at. So we've talked a lot about gameplay, but this is a spoiler cast. We're going to spoil the story. Luke, you just wrote a really cool article about Bayek and Aya and their marriage and just sort of how the game focuses on that. What did you think of the story overall? What did you think of their story and the story of Origins?
Yeah, so the reason I wrote that post was the thing that I focused on and enjoyed out of the narrative of Assassin's Creed Origins was that personal story, because mm-hmm. I thought the overarching story itself was maybe one of the most disastrously terrible in an Assassin's Creed game, like, ever. Like, I know they're not mm-hmm. renowned for having great stories. You know, the structure of these games doesn't lend themselves very well to a well-paced sort of zippy narrative. But even taking that into account, man, this game was difficult to follow and difficult to really get into the larger story beats, because it was just so... They would just throw characters in and out, and they wouldn't develop characters, and they would just drop things on you that hadn't been earned or explained. Yeah, I'm sure we'll get onto the ending soon. But yeah, so what I got out of it was I enjoyed the personal moments and the actual dialogue between characters. And so I thought Bayek and Aya's marriage was a really beautiful thing that was represented in a video game. I thought the way that the Crocodile Quest handled a similar sort of tragedy that Bayek and Aya have been through was a real sort of punch in the guts as well, that I think was handled really nicely. But those are the things I had to salvage out of a game that was sort of a wider wreck of a story.
Wow, I wouldn't call it a wreck. I remember, Kirk, you telling me that you were like, oh yeah, the last act of the game is kind of a mess. And when I played it just, I think, a shade more slowly than you did. And Luke, I don't know how quickly you made it through the ending. But I think I benefited from playing this game in fits and starts. It would cycle in and out of my rotation since late October, and I only finished it in mid-January in terms of the main story. And yes, those final acts or chapters or whatever go pretty quickly, and suddenly it's Flavius and it's Ptolemy, and he's killed, and then it's Caesar, and then it's Flavius. And
in a cutscene, Ptolemy is killed off camera at the end of a cutscene, I should point out. I thought that was pretty disappointing.
Yeah, Septimius, right? He's another main antagonist near the end who sort of comes and goes, and you're playing
so
as
after
Aya.
Saying all, you're going to say that there was a good story after you've just run down this
yes,
huge because, list of confusing bad guys.
Yes, because part of the fun of Assassin's Creed is the sort of cameos of all of these historical figures. And so they're rooted in the fact that some of these events did happen, right? That mm-hmm. Cleopatra was an historical figure, that Caesar rose to power, that he was assassinated, all this kind of stuff. And so they're getting to those. And yes, it's a different pace than the rest of the game, but a lot of that is self-directed. I played the game super slowly. I had, you know, my set of contracts of people that I was supposed to kill. And I took my time in that really cool city that's sort of being re-excavated from the sand. And I found the assassination of that guy really dissatisfying. I found many of those sort of main assassinations anticlimactic, but I really enjoyed how the story would build for each one, how you would understand the situation of each region and why the people were angry at a certain person, and how you would identify them and all that. And I always had in my mind that Ptolemy was the big bad guy, and I did find it clunky that he isn't the final showdown of the game. But it made sense to me, given that the Romans are an invading imperialistic force that are sort of stepping all over Egyptian culture, that Caesar would sort of step all over the rest of the game. Like, that mm-hmm. that fit. And I felt there was some unevenness in how much time we spent with Aya versus how much time we spent with Bayek, and that was a bit of the inelegance of the storytelling. But in terms of the historical tour and the fact that it accelerated near the end, I'm okay with that. I even think that if you slow down after the Ptolemy bits and the Romans really come to the fore, you can just mess around in that northwest region for a while and really delay that final section of game that you play where you go as Aya to Rome. And in that regard, you can go back to a more chill pace and just feel like you're Bayek now dealing with the Roman presence.
So I am, now that I've played through it twice and I've really sort of paid a much closer attention to the story and who's who and what's going on, I gotta say, like, it just bears the signs of AAA development and of writing a AAA game. It just really feels in that second half as though they had so much to tie together and so many things to relate back to these main characters that it just wasn't possible, because there are a lot of things going through it again where they were like, I was paying close attention. I knew who people were, and it wasn't just the villains. There is a scene that I remember from my first time through. Second time through was the same feeling when they say Flavius is the main guy, and Bayek says Flavius, and he's so mad. Like, we're supposed to know who the hell this guy is.
The deaths that matter, right? The marriage matters, though, right? It's the marriage and the mourning of the child, and the thing that Luke alluded to in terms of.
But there are these other things too. I mean, so that is great, and like that story is really good. But I feel like they were building up a thing with Cleopatra actually that would have been really good, and I'm sort of curious if that's gonna factor at some point because Cleopatra died. She killed herself, I guess, but someone smuggled in asps. Isn't that the deal with how she actually died? And I feel like there's enough there that feels already kind of like an Assassin's Creed game. Right. And playing through it again, really paying attention and knowing how everything plays out, it really feels like they're setting up Aya to kill Cleopatra. She ends the story by saying to Cleopatra, "If you get in my way, I'll kill you. The age of the pharaohs is over." And that, to me, felt like that made sense. And if Cleopatra turned on them, that sort of felt like where it was going anyways. But it just didn't quite play out that way. And instead, we get, you know, these Greek guys and these Roman guys that Cleopatra has aligned herself with temporarily. And then suddenly they're the big bad guys, and they're actually responsible for killing Chemu. And then also, Bayek killed his own son. And, I mean, I know he didn't, and he was set up, and he was sort of pushed into doing it. But that did happen at the beginning, and I didn't feel like... I thought that that would wind up being this, like, this interesting thing they could say about this guy who, as much as he's a likable dude, does go on this ridiculous murder spree throughout all of Egypt and kills thousands of people. That he's, this whole thing started because he killed his own son, whether by accident. That didn't come back. There's also, you come back and your friend and Siwa is dead. You get his flaming sword, and the whole thing is played up like it's a big deal, but the story didn't return to that guy at all since, you know, 30 hours ago, so you don't remember him. There are a lot of those kinds of clunky, like, okay, we're gonna force these two pieces back together and make it all hold up.
Like the story's too big.
The whole game is
which
too
the whole
big,
game which yeah, is what I was leaning to. The whole game is too big. We just spoke about having whole branches of the tech tree that we never investigated. The story falls over itself because it reaches so far and just can't tie everything together again. I managed to finish the game after playing it for like 80 hours, and there are entire regions of the map I've looked at that I haven't visited yet. They're still obscured. Like, I feel like they had 2 years. I don't want to pretend I'm knowledgeable of the development, you know, behind the game, but it feels like, as someone on this end of the game, that they had 2 years to make this, well, an extra year, whatever, to make this Assassin's Creed game. It's too big. It could have actually been a smaller game. It could have been a little bit more focused than sort of trying to reach as far as it did in terms of its scale and the narrative, and which it doesn't really succeed in.
I don't know if the issues, though, that you guys are talking about are because it's a AAA game or because it was 3 years or whatever. A lot of this is about how storytelling is done in an open world game. And you look at the way that an open world game has to function, or at least this is what we've seen so far in most open world games that we've played, is that it's very rare that there's a permanent conditional change across an entire open world. They have to account for the fact that you'll be playing things out of order. So the protagonist can never really be changed that fundamentally. The population of the regions can never change that fundamentally. And so the people making these games, I think, have to do this sort of awkward dance because they can't really have, like, Caesar have a huge presence early in the game in regions that he's not supposed to be in yet and then add him in later. Or at least maybe they could, but it just doesn't sort of fit with the way that these games tend to function in open world games. If I think to, like, Arkham Knight, There's a moment, and this is not an Arkham Knight spoiler cast, but so I won't go into it too specifically, but there's a moment where they do change the entire condition of Arkham City, but they then change it back by like the next chapter of the game, and then they resume to have like business as usual, all the quests are open in the world. Or if you think about how Grand Theft Auto San Andreas has a moment when there's a riot through the whole game, but then they have to like turn that off. And here, they kind of almost simulate the feel, or like sort of make it feel like something has changed, because they begin to emphasize the Romans later, but the Romans always were in the northwest region of the map. What is this? Basically Libya. They just haven't really allowed you to go there safely because it's been gated by the you know the system that Luke hates. They've kind of made it too hostile for you to go there. And that's a way that they're actually successfully able to make it feel slightly like things are changing a little bit in the world. But for the most part, they have this problem where if they want to tell fundamental new story beats to the game, they have to sequester them off into linear missions and cutscenes. And yes, they seem to have stuffed that all toward the end, maybe too much toward the end, and they could have paced that out more. But I don't think that making the game open world any smaller allows you to integrate Caesar into the game any more thoroughly or anything like that.
No, yeah. And I don't know if the size is really, that's the issue with the size. I mean, it does feel a bit diffuse. If you try to do all the side quests and play everything, it does feel too large, given that there's a point around level 32 where you're supposed to hit, you know, these major, you know, forward momentum story bits, and then suddenly you have to change gears again, and the game does seem to have sped up. But it's more with my gripes, I guess, with the structure are more that they don't return to things enough. They don't communicate clearly who you're supposed to care about and who you're not supposed to care about. Leaving the villains aside for a minute, just the fact that this friend that you go back to that then dies in Siwa and has died, and it's this tragic loss, and Bayek's super sad, and he gets his sword and vows to carry on for him. They could have had a quest somewhere in the middle there where you go back to Siwa for a minute and that guy needs help, and you say, oh, old friend, it's so good to see you again, and you talk to him and he tells you what's going on, and then you kind of remember him, you know, in another several hours when you go back and he's dead. That's the stuff that's kind of missing, that feels to me like they made so much game and then just said, okay, well, look, we got to end it, we got to have this stuff happen, but we haven't really like planned out perfectly how it's all going to work. And I totally understand that, since the game's so big and so ambitious, that's very hard to do.
As you're saying that, Kirk, I'm reminded, and this feels like eons ago, but you and I were talking when we were both sort of, you'd finished the game for a review, but I was playing it and I was fairly early on. And there was a section, it's like, is it east or southeast of Alexandria, where you go and you suddenly get like a million quests, and they're all based on this like small town. And there's this guy, and he's not quite like the sheriff, but he's somehow like the dude who's sort of aware of the different problems. And there's like, it's the first time they introduce you to like a mission table where there's just missions sitting there. And he tells you like there's this guy who's like been kind of ruining everything for everybody in the city, and you go after him. And I liked how they were like building up this story. And in retrospect, I realized they never go back to any of that. So that is its own like chapter of the book. And I like that. But I also realize I can't remember the names of any of the characters. I feel like there was a woman that I like went and rescued from like a destroyed town, or I went with her to like kill that guy.
Yep.
Yeah, the one with the lady with the
sole
face.
Survivor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a whole thing. And I think that was tied up with one of the main targets, I think. You kept coming back to it. But that also is another communication problem the game has, is that the targets all have nicknames. They were all wearing masks in the original cutscene, those that were there. You see them wearing masks in the sort of cutscenes that introduce them. And then you learn their real name right before you kill them. And it keeps happening to where, you know, if I look at this sheet, you know, like what the crocodile, she was sort of interesting because, you know, she's probably the one that you go after the hardest and takes the longest. She's responsible for Shadia's death, the little girl who dies, which is like easily, I'd say, one of the most impactful side quests. That area also is where, I don't know if you guys like this as much as I did, but it's where you meet Hilaris, who is the big bruiser outside of the arena. He's the big guy.
Oh, the old fighter.
Saying, yeah, and he says, youth is just a state of mind, and that's his catchphrase, and you do the thing with him. I really liked whoever wrote that quest. I thought that was a great, really well-written quest, and just great. And like that whole area feels good, and I remember the crocodile. I remember the woman, the hyena, I guess.
Yeah, the hyena was
great. Her daughter back. Yeah, that was really cool. And
wait,
sort
who
of a
was
weird
the hyena?
Fight.
I don't remember.
The hyena was the... She had hyenas, and the boss fight itself was pretty lame, how she would just sort of disappear across a sandstormy dune with a bow and arrow.
Oh, she's under the big pyramid. Yeah.
But like her character design and everything else was incredible.
And her story was cool because she was trying to bring her daughter back from the dead. And it was a sort of like anytime the story kind of kept coming back to these ideas of parents who'd lost their children, which is, you know, the Shadia's parents dealing with the same thing that Bayek and I are dealing with, the hyena trying to bring her child back. A lot of people, the guy, I'm forgetting his name now, but the guy who was unearthing the buried city, you know, you meet his family and then you go kill him. And then his family is, you know, his son doesn't understand and his wife is really angry with you. And you're saying, look, your husband was really horrible person.
Yeah, this is why the story is good. It was about something. It's like, how many video games actually have a theme? I feel like those trends.
No, I feel the opposite. And this is hard because I'm judging the game more harshly because of the things it does well. But it introduces these tantalizing themes that are there and they're good. And when they're good and when they're there, they're good. It's just that the majority of the game is still, it goes on in all these different directions. It goes on all these other tangents. It doesn't focus down on that one thing. And maybe it is because it's an open world game, and it's not fair to expect it to be as focused as something like The Last of Us or whatever, where there's just a clear-cut theme that runs through the game and is resolved in the resolution. But it still left me feeling like there were all these good ideas, but there was just too much game to spread them across, and maybe it's an impossible feat to spread those kinds of ideas across a game of that size. But I did feel like that was a little bit wanting.
You know what would have actually fixed a lot of these problems for all of us?
What?
A damn codex. Where's my guy Sean or whatever his name was writing snarky commentary about what's happening in all the, you know, moments of history and all the historical figures? There's no index. My theory, I've not asked anybody this. My hunch is that they save that labor for this history mode that they're creating and all that like very serious historical text, the blue triangle. Things that you can hit everywhere. But I really could have used a glossary of who the hell everybody is, a who's who.
And so, you know, I think that's actually a good segue into something else I want to ask you guys about, which is the present day stuff or the future stuff, I guess. The stuff with Layla exploring the Animus.
The main story of the series, the modern day, all listening to this who work at Ubisoft, this is your main story. Don't deny.
Do not neglect this in the next game. Luke, you're shaking your head in disgust.
Oh, it's absolutely insufferable. They were easily the lowest moments of the game. Anytime the camera fades to black and hit a loading screen and it cuts to that Animus chamber in the cave, my heart just sinks.
So one thing I will say is that each of those scenes is about 2 minutes long, which I did appreciate.
Yeah, that's not what I'm playing. I'm reading all the emails. I'm listening to all the files. That's not 2 minutes for me. I'm enjoying my time in the modern day. I love that stuff.
So I did like the emails and finding all the tie into the Watch Dogs universe and all of that stuff is sort of fun. Though I have to say that the story of the present day was just, and they just kicked the can down the road so royally, especially the second time through. Just there are, I think, four main plot beats, and it's basically that Layla goes into the Animus, she comes out and she's freaking out and she's on the radio with her friend Dee, and she finds Aya's body, and then I think nothing happens until she comes out again and she's under attack by Abstergo. I just think that's a crazy plot development. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know Abstergo is evil and everything, but she's an Abstergo researcher and she's gone off the grid to try something different. But what? And then suddenly they kill Deanna, I think, on the radio. And then she meets Desmond Miles' dad and he recruits her, whatever, into the Assassins. And it just felt like this big... Like, why couldn't it have been an actual story of what Desmond Miles' dad was up to?
Because haters like you crap on the modern day, so they're afraid to actually do like lots of modern day.
It's such an
irony. You guys have put Ubisoft are the victims here. You guys have put them in this position.
We're the victims having to play through this every year or two.
I love the modern day stuff.
I definitely am not as anti as Luke, but it is frustrating that if something actually happened in the modern day, I would like it more. Right. And if they really aren't committing to making more happen in the modern day because they know people don't like it, that is a catch-22, where if you commit to it more, you know, if people don't like it, you want to keep it really kind of optional. But it's like, make it interesting. I used to be interested in what was happening. There's no reason it has to be these really perfunctory present day things that they've done in the last few games. I was expecting a little bit more and was definitely bummed out by it. It was just sort of an incoherent story. It didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it's strange that they've got previous games where I'm sure the reception has been more positive to that kind of section. Like how Black Flag's sort of first person mode, where there wasn't very much to do at all, but it was far more enjoyable to sort of poke around the corners of the offices and have a look around there than it was just waking up in this cave with a laptop. and sort of that was it.
Right. And just, and yeah, and Layla seems like a cool character. Like, I could see her becoming, like, I have a feeling that she'll be in the next game as well. I kind of hope that we keep following her the way that we followed Desmond. So one thing I'm curious about also related to this, and I don't know whether you guys have seen this. Did either of you, Steven, did you see any of the special codes that you can unlock in the tombs in the game where you hear from the precursor race and they read these missives to you over the radio?
Of course. Of course. Oh, you did. It's essential. You're okay. Talking about like the sort of like you see suddenly. I mean, there's one you have to see, right? Because you see one when you're on your way to
the hyena, actually. When Flavius. That's right, when you find her.
No, but when Flavius, you write that one. And then when you're going to hunt down Flavius, you know, that guy you've been hating the whole game.
Yes.
And
yes.
You go into the
nemesis.
You go back to see what he's easy the Joker to the Bikes Batman.
And yes, definitely.
You go in there and you see some of that. But I had already been exploring. I just go off the beaten path as much as possible. I'd also gotten a suggestion from somebody who knew the game better than I did that I should head to the southernmost part of the map. And I would find what is eventually that trench, that trench that has that the temple.
It looks like something out of Breath of the Wild, I think. I really like that.
Yeah,
that
I actually don't. But I don't know. Spin your heads even more. I actually was disappointed in those messages and those chambers because the modern day at least had the grounding of it being like a character who had a name, who had, you know, I could read some of the history and sort of get what was going on there. And I am disappointed that the modern day barely ever makes any progress and they haven't really wanted to push it forward since the Desmond stuff ended in AC3. But at least there was a character there. And the Isu stuff instead it reminds me of, was it AC2 or Brotherhood, where by doing certain like brain teaser puzzles, you could unlock very small fragments of what was essentially a video of Adam and Eve running through the Garden of Eden or something like that.
That might have even been the first Assassin's Creed. I can't remember which one that was. I think it was two.
It never really amounted to anything other than a short, like, mysterious, what the hell is this video? And the Isu stuff is like that throughout this game, where it's like, okay, they're saying weird philosophical things. Oh, they're mentioning Juno or Minerva or Desmond or whatever. But it could mean anything. And it's sort of like just a Rorschach, you know, blot of a script right there. And make of it what you will in terms of whether it's advancing anything. I mean, I'm looking at the globe and I'm looking at the parts that are illuminated. And I'm like, are these the locations for past and future Assassin's Creed games? Oh, there's something lit up in the Japanese part of the map. We're going to Japan finally. But... you know, I just like, what does any of that mean? I don't know.
Yeah. It's reassuring to hear you say that, since I know that you tend to listen to those things very closely and to pay attention for that kind of detail. Because I found myself interested. Occasionally they would say something that implied, you know, something about Desmond stopping the end of the world and how that set a new timeline in motion. And that seems kind of interesting. But I just found myself, those audio logs were so long. They just were very long, like 3 or 4 minutes long or something. And I just would find myself sort of looking over at Twitter on my other screen after a while. And I tried really hard to focus on what they were saying, and I just couldn't hold the sentences in my mind. Because like you said, it does feel like a Rorschach test. That's a really good way of putting it, that it's just sort of vague shit that could mean a lot of different things, because they obviously, it doesn't mean something specific because they don't want to commit to anything because they want to be able to change it.
The main thing I like about them is that I always appreciate when a big corporate AAA game gets weird. And Assassin's Creed games, I'd say like Unity wasn't weird enough. It was one of the many things I had issues with Unity. It was just too straight-laced. It was going to sort of do its thing. I guess a counter-argument would be, oh yeah, you can go to climb the Eiffel Tower. You can go into the future and climb the Eiffel Tower and collect nodes with speedruns. But it's just like early AC games, you were like, via the Animus, you were doing brain teasers that were illuminated on the walls. You were like, you were finding hidden messages in pictures of the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court justices to figure out which of them were Templar sympathizers and stuff like that. And so to have anything that sort of touches on, oh yes, Assassin's Creed is also about weird history and it's about like odd Machiavellian figures and about Machiavelli himself. I appreciated that and I like that. But there's just, it was, to me, too little of that, and you can see them being very tentative about committing to anything that is other than the historical tourism exploration stuff that they're doing. And they've got a problem. They've tried to solve some of it by saying, we're going to do more of the modern-day story in the comics. And I've been trying to commit to reading some of the comics. I dabbled with them. I wasn't that into it. And it's been controversial among the super fans because some of them are really passionately interested in modern day. They're frustrated that a lot of that story's been removed to the comics. I got to read those to find out if at least it's satisfying to get more of the narrative there. But it's deficient, and I don't really know what they do. Like, is Layla going to return in the next game? And are they going to build on her? Remember, Desmond barely did anything in AC1, and he did a lot more in AC2. And will people react well or negatively to that? I don't know.
Yeah, I would think that a little bit of connectivity would just be nice to make it feel like there's a new... This feels like a new starting point, I guess. So it feels like they could do a sequel that could be about Bayek and Aya. You know, they could just keep it going and go to Rome or something. I don't know.
They've built up a whole cast of, like, Brotherhood characters. Because that's one of the things I liked about this game is how you're slowly but surely assembling a crew of people and they show up around that table at the end. So the mission I mentioned in the Northeast where Sinu goes missing, you meet this woman who you go back a bit with and she helps you like save this crocodile. She's cool. I can't remember her name. There's the woman you meet in the Northwest who's the Greek woman, Praxilla or something. And they describe her later as like a healer. And it seems like you have this crew of people that they could then explore more in subsequent games. And like other characters that are probably not emphasized enough in this game to really make them stick as much as they should. But they are assembling a cast that's interesting, right. And I could see them going to like a Bayek trilogy a la Ezio. I mean, he feels like there's
enough
to
him.
Yeah,
or like a standalone Aya game would rule. I would totally play that. As long as there's no naval sections at all, because I hate the naval sections in Assassin's Creed Origins. I thought they were a huge bummer. So we're almost out of time. We should wrap up. I have closing questions for both of you that are specifically tailored to each of you. Luke, your closing question about Assassin's Creed Origin. I know that you weren't really feeling this game at first, and then something sort of got you over the hump, and then you realized that you were, oh yeah, this game is fine, I'm into it. What was it that changed for you?
I've thought about this a bit, and I think it's very similar to what got me with The Witcher 3, in that there's a point where the game initially begins and you're almost in a straitjacket, and you're like, whoa, I thought this was an open world game with vast scale and all this action and characters. And it's a very pedestrian introductory sequence to this game where you're not doing much. The missions are kind of boring. The characters are like, eh, the town's a bit drab. It's very sort of tutorial based. But there's that point where you're on horseback and you get out into the wilderness and the title screen sort of flashes up as you sort of see the scale of Egypt behind it, and you sort of go, oh man, actually this, and it's just that sort of a moment. And I had a very similar moment with The Witcher 3 where you sort of leave the White Orchard at the beginning and the wind's blowing in the trees and the sun setting and you look over a mountain and you see this sort of world open up in front of you. And I guess Breath of the Wild has one too. It's just much earlier. But that sort of moment that it hits you that, oh, this game, here is the massive scale of this game laid out in front of me. I'm going to have a lot of fun kicking the tires of this and riding around and enjoying and exploring it and seeing what it's got to offer. So I just thought with Origins, it takes a little bit too long to get to that moment. I thought the grind in Siwa lasts for a little bit too long before it sort of pushes you out the door and says, all right, go and ride some boats and kill some guys and have some fun.
Steven, you are known as, by me anyways, as somebody who does all of the side stuff in Assassin's Creed games. There's so much side stuff in this game. I, even as someone who pledged to do all the side stuff and has done quite a bit of it, I'm still feeling kind of overwhelmed by the side quests. Especially given that you are a relatively recent father and don't have a ton of gaming time, do you really see yourself 100%ing this game?
I think I'm going to do it the same way that I did the others, which is that I don't know if I technically ever 100% them, but I'd certainly clear the map of everything that there is to do. I think I'll come close to that. I do wonder if I'm not going to do every like
vulture lairs and hyena.
Yeah, maybe. Really... Am I not? But I think I will, because if I've done so much other stuff. The thing is, it's been interesting playing this game in the same 12-month period that I played Breath of the Wild, because both games I had a very similar experience with where I wasn't that into them early on, and I'm a big fan of both series, and then the games grew on me. And in both cases, it's just because I really began to fall in love with the game world that I was in and found it beautiful and just satisfying to explore. And in neither case was it because something big and dramatic happened, but it was just that slow accretion of good experiences, of... this the pleasure of hiking through something virtually. And I found that maybe Breath of the Wild was more satisfying in terms of gameplay because they'd bake a lot of puzzles into the environment. So there'd be, you know, some way to engage with the, like that push, sort of push and pull of, oh, I've run into some sort of obstacle or challenge, and how will I overcome that in terms of how will I move these blocks around, or how will I get through this snowy area? And I like that kind of gaming challenge, gameplay-based challenge. I think that with Origins, it was less of a gameplay challenge. I kind of knew how to do everything when I would get to it. It was just kill these people or, you know, run this race or something like that. But I was always getting to a new place that I just felt was interesting to be in. And I was constantly thinking, I wonder if this is what it actually looked like back in the day. And am I actually having this rare pleasure and experience of seeing Egypt, of that era, recreated? And I found that really satisfying and beautiful. And I also really enjoyed how the side quests began to subvert some of my expectations in terms of what I thought they were. As I played, I was looking for more and more systems that I would be excited by and that I would find fun to engage with. So I was excited, like, for the – what are the sleeping areas called? The side quests?
Oh, yeah, the meditation spots or something.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, there's going to be a whole new side activity there. That's going to be fun because I am notoriously into finding the most obscure side stuff, like an AC3. I love the stuff that nobody else does, like the brawls that span the map or the underground exploration or all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, finding these places where you have to sleep is going to be exciting. And then it's like not that exciting. It's just like go to sleep and get in a bed.
I like that you said the sentence, finding these places where you sleep is going to be exciting, and then you were surprised when it was not exciting.
Well, I guess I didn't realize you were going to sleep there, so maybe that was it. No, but I thought maybe you go into like a dream thing, like
right.
By the way, guys, thumbs up, thumbs down on the big snake fight. Thumbs down.
Big thumbs down.
Yeah.
Not a fan.
Bad. Okay, just gotta get that. So, yeah, like, I like though, like the Phylakes. I'm going to go kill them all because I think that's a really good idea.
Oh, yeah.
Have these uber enemies roaming through each city and like have to kill each one. That's great.
I know this is a spoiler cast, but I know that neither of you have beaten the Phylakes. I have, and it's actually really cool, and it has a very neat final chapter, and I'll just say that. So you should beat them because they're cool.
Yeah. They could have done more with the boats, the river boats that are always going through, you know, they're going through the river. And like you can go on them and you can fight them, the captains. But I didn't find them to be that exciting.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, there's been some anticlimax to some of the side questing, which would be the main obstacle. But I do enjoy just being in this game world. I just enjoy chipping away and doing things. And there's always some beautiful sight to see and some new area of the map to unfog. So, like, I found this crazy, like you do the papyrus quests, right? Sorry, I'm just free associating, but this is sort of how you play the game, too. It's like, I'm doing this. No, I'm doing that now. The papyrus quests are great, and they, on paper, shouldn't be because – No pun with that on paper and papyrus, but you're being told, like, go to this special place where this tree is. And it's like, I'm just being told to go somewhere. Like, that's not that exciting. But those clues get more esoteric the more you play, the later papyrus things that you get. And the places that you wind up finding yourself in where the treasure is buried wind up being more and more exotic and interesting. There's a place in the southeast where they say go to a place where birds should be, and it's basically what should be a lookout point, like a sink point, and it's not. But you then dive off it, and like where you land is very interesting in terms of how they've designed it, and the treasure being there is sort of like a cool touch. Maybe that doesn't sound super appealing when I describe it, but it's just like there's really beautifully designed spots in the game.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. That's some of the places that you find in the game that are a little bit squirreled away and you wouldn't go to because the map is just so comically big.
Yeah.
Once you get to them, sometimes they're really interesting or they're just beautiful looking on their own. And it's like you almost have to put yourself in, you know, walking simulator mode or something where suddenly you're just appreciating this cool space that you're in and the story that it tells. And then you're moving back into Ubisoft open world, you know, dude gameplay of checking things off. So that makes sense. Well, this has been a lot of fun, guys. I think we all have, generally have mixed feelings about Assassin's Creed Origins, but I'm glad that we all finished it and we got to do our usual Assassin's Creed geek out session. So, Luke and Steven, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks, Kirk.
Yeah, thanks for having us.